This is FM 90.1 Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia, we'll be talking about disappearing places around planet Earth.
Oh, can you take care of her? Oh, maybe you can spare her several moments of your consideration leading up to the final destination.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Tonight, we're doing a replay of a discussion we had a couple of months ago with Christina Conklin. She's co-author of An Atlas of Disappearing Places. She's an artist as well as a writer, and as you'll hear in the interview, she's done maps of disappearing places on thin sheets of kelp. Yes, dried kelp from Ocean's Bounty.
We have a preview copy of that book, and if you'd like to have it, send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com.
Sorry,
ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com, and tell us how you'd like to get it. We'll get it to you somehow. First come, first serve, so email us right away.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Neil Yelland, a financial advisor with Edward Jones in Chico. No matter where you are in life's journey, Neil can offer guidance and strategies for wealth and retirement income, college savings accounts, estate and legacy plans, charitable giving, and more. For a consultation or more information, Neil can be reached at 530-345-89113. I'm going to go back a little bit. I don't think he's seeking a consolation. I think it's a
consultation.
Consultation.
That's
thank you.
That's what makes sense there.
Okay. They're on the corner of 3rd Avenue Esplanade. Neil Yelland, Edward Jones, member SIPC. And Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the merchants at 4th and Broadway in downtown Chico, right beneath the KZFR studios. Baker's Birkenstock, Cotton Party, Chico Paper Company offer a unique selection of clothing, jewelry, footwear, custom framing, and artwork of all kinds. They're located close to nearby parking, cafes, eateries, and the skating rink. Cotton Party, Baker's Birkenstock, and Chico Paper Company are here to serve you.
The opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
Before we have our interview with Christina Conklin about Earth's disappearing places, we want to remind you that coming up at 6 o'clock this evening, it's North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon. She'll be talking with Pam Larry about local food initiatives here in town. Then at 6:30, it's Ginger Nichols with Radioactive. In addition, on Thursday, December 9th, 6 to 7 people, 7 p.m., Dr. Gail Kimball will help us learn the backgrounds of the December holidays of Christmas and Hanukkah. Listen to interviews with CSUC Comparative Religion Professor Daniel Weidlinger and Rabbi Lisa Rappaport of Congregation Beth Israel. In addition, we want to tell you about a fundraiser for the Butte Environmental Council coming up on Friday of this week, the 10th. It's at the Day Camp Coffee Shop. It's open to the public. The public is invited to come in about 6:30. There will be entertainment by the Chico Big Swing Band. You can get your tickets at Becknet.org. Susan is shaking her head. I said something wrong. Now, here's our interview with Christina Conklin.
Thank you. Well, what do you know? He smiled at me in my dreams last night. My dreams are getting better all the time. And what do you know? He smiled at me in a different light. My dreams are getting better all the time. To think that we were strangers a couple of nights ago, and though it's a dream, I never dreamed he'd ever say hello. Oh, maybe tonight I'll hold him tight when the moonbeam shines. My dreams are getting better all the time.
Well, that was a leftover from my show on Saturday, Swing City. You're invited to hear more every 3 o'clock on Saturday, Swing City. Now we'll see if we have the CD with Christina Conklin in our machine.
Takes a minute to load.
There have been CD problems here at the studios of late, and we're too klutzy in any way to compensate for those problems. There we go. Roll 'em, Dano. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. I'm Stephen Schutte. Tonight we'll be talking about places around the world where oceans and coasts are threatened. From Hawaii to Bangladesh, from Kenya to Antarctica, from Peru to London. Our guest on the phone is Christina Conklin, who co-authored the Atlas of Disappearing Places with Marina Saros. Sorry about that, Marina, who's not with us. In addition to writing the text, Christina also did maps and illustrations for the book using a highly unusual artistic process, which we're going to ask about a little bit further on in the interview.
Christina is an artist, writer, and researcher whose work investigates the intersection of natural systems and belief systems, often using the ocean as both site and metaphor. She holds an MFA from California College of the Arts and has exhibited internationally. She lives in Half Moon Bay. Welcome, Christina Conklin.
So good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's start by asking you to describe the scope of the Atlas. It's a beautiful book. It's a full-size book, a coffee table-size book, though I hesitate to use that term. It covers 20 places around the world where oceans and coastlines are in jeopardy. But it's also got a very skillful structure to take up ecological and environmental issues as well. Christina, how did you work out this structure? What was the process of coming to compose the book this way?
Well, we wanted to tell stories that would be very accessible to readers and have a different a voice than your normal scientific paper. And so we wanted to pick particular places and pair each place with a particular climate change impact that is, you know, being experienced in that place, and then write a story about it. So we really just chose places that were of personal interest to us, that also, you know, touched on an important issue, everything from ocean acidification to melting polar ice caps to coastal flooding. So my co-author and I both have, you know, wide-ranging interests, and we both love the ocean. So we really tried to touch on all of the most important issues. And the book falls into four categories. Changing chemistry. So we have five stories on all the different ways that the very fundamental chemical nature of the ocean is being changed, from pollution to ocean acidification, for instance. And then strengthening storms. That's, of course, happening all over the world. So we have five stories about that, in both in rural and urban locations. And warming waters, you know, the both the poles are experiencing major changes in ice loss. And that is also happening. So the water is warming all over the ocean, from the surface waters to the depths. And that's creating these rolling impacts that are really quite serious and that we don't really hear about very often, like growing ocean dead zones. And then finally, rising seas, which is something that we do hear about. It's actually going to be kind of the last major impact that is felt on in the ocean. The other things are already happening now, and seas are rising a little bit, but the curve of change is going to increase radically in about 30 years.
And then how did you find particular locations? Like, you've got Camden, Maine in the chemistry segment. You've got San Juan, Puerto Rico in storms. That one we can figure. Warming waters, Kisiti, Kenya, coral collapse, rising seas. We're going to ask you about the Thames Estuary. But a very diverse, you cover the whole planet in these places. How did you identify these places and get them into the slots in your book?
Yeah, well, we mostly started with each issue. So we knew we wanted to have a chapter on coral, and we knew we wanted to have a chapter on, I wanted to write a chapter on cultural heritage in the world and what's at risk to our cultural heritage. And there are really important sites around the world that are right at the water's edge or very close. And so sea level rise poses a great risk to, you know, not only just St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice and all of Venice, but also some prehistoric sites that are, you know, a little harder to get to, but very, very important in terms of human heritage. So I think we each wrote about half the chapters, and we chose a passion topics for ourselves. And so that was, you know, starting with the key issues, we just got journalistic and followed our noses and followed the research to find examples of places that would also then be, that could be extrapolated all over the world. So I think the other thing about the book is that there are these 20 stories, but in each chapter is also a map that shows how this same issue affects the whole places all over the world, because each issue, of course, is global. So we wanted, that to me was a very important element to show that we're all in this together.
Yeah. Now we get to the really unique part of your book, and that is your art. We did, we'll try to do a little visual radio here. Each chapter contains brightly colored maps and charts and illustrations of coastline, some scientific data, individual creatures, and more. And it looks like these were done on crumpled wrapping paper, but they're not. Please tell us how you created these graphics, which are so unusual, and I've never seen anything like this in a book. So this is a very unique part. Tell us about what you did.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I have always worked with, as an artist, unconventional materials, and I actually started gathering seaweed from the bay in Half Moon Bay, and drying it and processing it and stretching it and working with it, and then painting on it. And so this this is seaweed. It's a product of the sea to illustrate the issues in the sea. And it does. It looks like it's a little bit like working with tissue paper. It's very delicate. Yeah. And if it gets wet, it just dissolves back into seaweed. And the ink is water soluble, too. So I like the you know, the transience, the delicacy of it, and it has a sort of veiny, vital quality that is just a little bit unusual. Yeah.
So how do you preserve it? I mean, do you put it in behind glass or in cellophane, or how do you keep that fragility from just kind of crinkling away and falling apart?
They are fragile, and that's part of what I like about them. So I don't actually do anything to preserve them. So they start a dark green, a beautiful, translucent, papery dark green, and then they fade to a parchment color, sort of like a manila envelope color. And I can work with that as well. So, you know, sort of depending on when I make it, and if I, you know, if I put it in a dark drawer, it lasts. If I leave it exposed to the light, all that chlorophyll will fade away. So I actually think that's part of the beauty of it. And
it's metaphorical as well, the fragility of your medium.
Exactly.
I'm looking at the moment at the map of Vietnam, and I'm just curious, not necessarily about that one, but how did you get the maps onto the kelp, and then how did you decide on the inks? Did you use brushes, pens? And then my last question before I stop asking, you also superimposed some lines, and I'm guessing maybe that was done with Photoshop or something of that sort.
Right. So some of the maps are a scanned image of a seaweed map, and they're very sort of textured, and the inks are like a water-soluble translucent ink, so they have this kind of watercolory quality. Mm-hmm. Many of the maps are digitally layered on a satellite map to give a little bit more geographical reference points. So for like New York City, you can see the shape of New York City, the sort of topography of New York City underneath. And the seaweed looks like it's sort of consuming New York City, washing over it, which I also like. So I painted the climate maps are all taken directly from scientific research papers. So I didn't invent any information here. This is coming straight out of research papers, and I literally just transpose that onto the seaweed and then layer it digitally onto the other map and add the Photoshop lines and the labels and captions and things, and they have a lot of information in them. Hopefully they're sort of, again, extrapolating what's in the chapter, so people can get a picture speaks a thousand words.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, there are multiple levels of information in each of the maps, which I think is really cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Well, we'd like to explore a couple of locations that you chose to illustrate. Again, listeners, there are 20 locations. We obviously can't, we would be too thin to try to cover all 20. So we picked out a couple that particularly interested us, and we'll also ask Christine if she'd read to us a little bit. So one of the areas, Cook Island, that's in the segment on changing chemistry. And it starts with a story, but then it gets into what's happening around the Cook Islands. I wondered if you would be willing to read a section for us.
Surely. I'll just read the first page of this chapter. It's called Feeding the Fever. A 50-year-old man was admitted to Rarotonga Hospital with heavy diarrhea, vomiting, weakness, and severe joint and muscle pain. There's a little graphic detail here. Anything cold felt burning hot to the touch, and anything hot was ice cold. 2 hours earlier, he had eaten red snapper, or angamea, a common reef fish, and had unwittingly caught ciguatera, a severe form of food poisoning. The man was given IV fluids and antiemetics, but no further treatment was available. So after 3 weeks of slow improvement, he was released from the hospital. In the meantime, all his pigs had died after eating the viscera of that same fish. His cat was paralyzed for weeks, but survived. His chickens had to be killed, and his neighbor's dogs died after eating discarded fish parts out of the garbage. The man's joint pain and tingling skin lasted for more than a year, one of the lasting health effects that can include numbness in the arms and legs, cardiovascular damage, and re-triggered symptoms upon any future consumption of meat, fish, or alcohol. As inhabitants of a nation of scattered islands and atolls in the South Pacific, Cook Islanders rely on seafood for both protein and income. Yet up to 10% of islanders get ciguatera poisoning every year, a sickness caused by the genus Gambir discus, which are single-celled protists the width of a human hair that look like slightly squashed yo-yos. Once rare, ciguatera has reached epidemic rates worldwide, with perhaps 500,000 cases a year, and it is now the world's most common form of non-bacterial seafood poisoning. For tourists, ciguatera means the sudden miserable end of a long-planned vacation. for people living throughout the tropics, outbreaks weaken both public health and food security when local fishing grounds are closed for months or years. Colorless and odorless, gambir discus is impervious to freezing and cooking, and it bioaccumulates, making people sicker with each exposure. People are forced to buy expensive imported food or risk it on the reef.
Horrible. is there any sort of anti-venom for the virus? Is there anything that can kill the virus? Or is it?
Yeah. Well, so this is the interesting thing. Part of what I learned in researching all these microorganisms is that this isn't a virus. This is a protist, which is a different category of life altogether. It's not animal or vegetable or mineral. It's a protist, which is and they're these microscopic organisms, and there is nothing. There is no antidote for this. So this man, you know, was very sick and slowly recovered. Some people have symptoms that last a long, long time. I think your listeners will, you know, we all appreciate this a little bit more now with COVID, that
yes,
a microorganism, you know, can wreak havoc, and it doesn't necessarily go away or get better. And it is, you know, the other thing is that Ciguatera does occur naturally, but the reason it's happening more is that it thrives on disturbed and dead coral reefs. So, of course, the coral reefs are all dying because of warming waters and ocean acidification. And developing economies often use dead coral as like a construction material. They, you know, put it out to build, you know, quays or piers or building sites on their limited land. So they add a little land by piling up rubble, and you know, which sort of makes sense in one way, but it also allows these diseases to proliferate. So, you know, this is a combination of sort of a natural system run amok, really, that is being exacerbated by climate change.
Right.
Is that remediable, do you think?
That's what I just asked.
Either through protection of the coral or other changes to the chemistry, or maybe ocean warming.
Yeah, this is tricky. Some of many of the topics we cover in the ocean chemistry and ocean warming sections of the book really are with us to stay, because they are, you know, the ocean covers 71% of the Earth. It's, you know, the biggest living system on Earth, and we have already unleashed some changes that for the next few hundred years really are going to continue. I can't, you know, I guess I can't read the future about harmful algal blooms like this, but they are predicted to get worse unless we stop polluting, right? And there are nearshore algal blooms that are caused by too much fertilizer that gets washed down from farms. There's all different causes of algal blooms in particular, but the fact is ocean warming and ocean acidification, among other changes, are, you know, are with us to stay for a good long while, yeah.
Then your map talks about kilograms of manganese nodules per square meter. Those go out from the islands. What is manganese? What's it all about, these nodules?
Right. So the mining industry has decided that deep sea mining is the next gold mine, and they're not wrong. There's a lot of minerals on the ocean floor, and manganese happens to be fairly common on land as well. So this is not needed in any sense. But what they do is they send down like a caterpillar machine and just scrape the ocean floor. The deep ocean floor and take up these manganese. They're like a little fist-sized lump, right? And manganese is used in steel and in tin cans and many other industrial materials. But I guess the point of the chapter is that this is a totally unnecessary means of production of something that might be necessary in our lives. And it's, you know, they, this tiny island country, with only 15,000 people stands to make a whole lot of money. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the other side of that coin is that they passed a law in 2017 to protect all of their territorial waters, which are extensive, as a sustainable, you know, environmentally healthy region. And, you know, it's just really tragic that major industrial firms can come in and, you know, woo a few of the local leaders with a promise of mm-hmm. lots of cash. Mm-hmm. And basically they just overran the law. And have already started mining the floor, which could destroy, you know, all the coral habitats up in the shallow waters, and it's just really unleashing it's a very poorly understood form of mining, and nobody's done enough research yet. So it's just a cautionary tale of like how much power you know money has, and how this island nation's, you know, traditional culture and their strong relationship with the sea and, you know, both sort of a you know, spiritual as well as economic and functional sense is, you know, really has come to a head. Mm-hmm. And this could happen all over the world, you know.
Right. Yes, I was going to say, to bring it closer to home, we did a program a few weeks ago on lithium mining in Nevada, which is going to take place on Native American territories. The people are fighting it, but the lithium corporations are saying we need it for the batteries. We also know that here in California, recently announced projects in the Salton Sea in Southern California, they've figured out how to extract lithium from the dregs of the Salton Sea, which has, of course, gone dry over generations. And it, in turn, was formed accidentally when a dike broke on the Colorado River. So extraordinarily complex, but we cannot underestimate the ability of industry to figure out new ways to extract stuff from the planet.
With unintended consequences.
Unintended consequences, and never mind the people who are living there.
Right.
And okay. I think this is actually one of my reasons for writing the book, was really to peel back some of this and to say, look, we need to look at our values and our culture and move rapidly away from this extractive form of economics that mm-hmm. we are living in right now, because we are, you know, we're throwing the planet on which we depend into a really, really dangerous position.
Yes.
And, you know, and it's really for our own benefit, of course, and all of the other creatures in the world. Like, we need to reintegrate ourselves into the natural system rather mm-hmm. than this sort of rape and pillage approach that
right.
Is happening in so many places.
So one chapter describes life in the North Atlantic as ocean temperatures rise. There's a gorgeous painting that accompanies this chapter. You have a full-page map that charts the sea temperatures, and then you have some paintings that show the little creatures that live in the in this region, and one that shows the jellyfish population. So it's a really interesting chapter visually, as well as important in terms of ocean temperature rises. What can you tell us about the threats to the North Atlantic creatures?
Yes, well, I found this fascinating too. I guess I've fallen in love with these little microorganisms because when you look at them under the microscope, they are actually beautifully complicated. They're very sophisticated, from diatoms to something called a coccolithophore, which is it's a one-celled creature, and it builds a little shell for itself made out of these little discs. Made out of calcium carbonate. Like, I don't know how they do it. You know, it's really remarkable. It makes me feel a little bit stupid.
Yes. Looks a little
I can't
like
do
a,
anything like that.
Looks a little like a soccer ball.
Right.
Fancy like a soccer ball, like an artistic soccer ball, one that's been created by an artist. But yeah,
that's
sorry,
right.
we're kind of getting away from our topic. But yeah, they're really beautiful. And I mean, related to what you were just saying, and then I'm going to let you answer the question, that because we can't see a lot of these things, it's harder to connect to them and to see how our world is the same or a part of their world, how we're all interconnected. We can see things like giraffes and elephants, but we're not so good about taking care of them either. But since we can't see these things, it's like they're not there, but they are.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What's their status?
Well, you know, it's this enormously complex web out there in the ocean. There are layers, vertical layers running throughout the ocean at different temperatures and different amounts of light all the way down to the deep sea floor. And some of these creatures live in the upper, the phytoplankton, the ones that create oxygen, the ones that photosynthesize and give us oxygen to breathe. Half of the oxygen on Earth is created by phytoplankton in the ocean. So that's one thing to know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're not endangered per se, but if the cycles of the ocean fall out of balance, it's called a mismatch. And you know, if the phytoplankton bloom too soon in the season, and then the little zooplankton, the little animal plankton, don't have anything to eat because they have already bloomed and died, like this can cascade up the food web quite rapidly, as it did in the as I say in this chapter, the cod fishery in northeastern U.S. and Canada in the 80s and 90s. People may remember there was a collapse in the cod fishery, so. That was partly because of climate change, and it was because of overfishing. But I think we have not seen clearly enough what the impacts of warming waters are doing in these, especially in these cold northern and southern ocean waters. The tropics are, you know, have a little bit more stability, except as I was just saying about the harmful algal blooms. This challenge happens at the poles, and in the North Atlantic, there really is a change happening in the ecosystem there, and it could have long term consequences for the fisheries in that region.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's the future? We're going to talk a little bit later about your projections for 2050, but what do you see as again remediation for the North Pacific, the North Atlantic? What could we or anybody or global agencies do to help preserve
it? Well, I mean the real answer is that the thing we can do to slow and stem the ocean warming, ocean acidification, these kind of rolling, these changes that are increasing in speed, the thing we can do is address our cultural addiction to fossil fuels. We can really crack down on big oil and gas, go to alternative energy sources, develop ways to sequester carbon back into through forestation, or they're reforesting the sea with kelp that absorbs a lot of carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, I think a lot of people are working really, really hard at how to, drive down our carbon emissions. But at the moment, they're still going up because we still burn fossil fuels. And so honestly, everything else is trimmings around the edges. And that is the thing that we as a world need to come together and do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Christina Conklin. She's the author with Marina Sauros of The Atlas of Disappearing Places. A beautiful book. with multiple strands of information, scientific information, projections into the future, as well as data describing very specifically what's going on at 20 locations around the world.
And stories and art as well.
Yes.
Yes. Your chapters conclude with a view from 2050 describing possible futures. Maybe you can tell us about what is happening in the Thames estuary today and what will happen if Britain doesn't take major measures to stabilize or reverse climate change. And possibly you can read to us again in the United Nations mid-century view, as in most of Europe, is the section that we hoped you would read.
I'll just set it up a little bit.
Good,
so,
please.
London, of course, is inland. It's actually about 40 miles or more up the Thames River from the English Channel. But as a river city, like so many river cities or estuary cities in the world, sea level rise is going to be its biggest problem in about 50 years. And right now, everybody has their head in the sand, and everybody's working on as if things are going to change in a linear way, but climate change is not linear. There's a graph people may have seen. They call it the hockey stick graph. Basically, we're on this kind of slow ascent, and then at about 2050, the graph really takes off, and it just heads to the sky. And that is going to be the rate of change. And it's an increase in temperatures, and it's an increase in sea levels. And you know, that's why the smart money right now is about preparing and, you know, pulling all that carbon out of the atmosphere so we can get back down to safe pre-industrial levels where the planet was in equilibrium. I do want to say that these ideas governments are talking about right now, the net zero idea by 2050, is a false idol, really. That's not going to be enough soon enough, because all that does is basically zero out it levels off our emissions. It doesn't drive them down, and we have to drive them down as quickly as possible from its current level, which is 420 parts per million, back down to like 300. It's a huge job we have ahead of us, and I do have hope we can do it, but in London, for instance, you know, they have a storm barrier. They've had it. Mm-hmm. They had a big flood in the 50s, and then they built a barrier. It took them 30 years to build it.
Right.
But it's already old and outdated and going to be obsolete very, very soon. So, but the politicians don't want to really address this, and they feel a lot of pressure to do economic development, housing development. So they are, you know, kicking the can, which is what politicians so often do. So I'll read just through a couple of chapters here.
I just wanted to interrupt for a second and delay your reading. The barriers in the Thames are another example of what we call the techno fix that we've been warned about. That, okay, if you can, there may be problems, but if you can invent big enough machinery to solve the problem, whether it's disposing of nuclear waste, shoot it into orbit, or build these hoods in around. They remind me of the Martian vehicles in the movie War of the Worlds. they're not going to work. They're not going to solve the long-term problem. They're a temporary techno fix. Sorry for that interjection. Please tell us about 2050 in London.
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess just one additional point. I mean, Britain is an island. I mean, we have an enormous amount of coastline in this country, and you can't build a wall around an entire country. And you have to think that sea level rises everywhere, right? This is a big, complicated problem that is requires some really complicated thinking to address it. So. Anyway, okay, a view from 2050. In the United Nations mid-century review of how nations had handled climate change, Britain ranked last on the list of adaptive capacity in developed countries. Part of this was due to its island geography, which had more shoreline per capita than most of its peers, But the majority was the result of political and planning choices the British government had made in the decades before, in the 2010s and 2020s. As predicted, the years immediately before and after Brexit and the COVID depression sucked all the energy out of the country, leaving little space for thoughtful climate adaptation planning or serious infrastructure investment. The 2018 report from the Committee on Climate Change, an independent advisory panel to the government, was the only candid critique in this period, outlining what was at risk. Up to 1.5 million properties, including 1.2 million homes, in the flood zone, and over 100,000 properties at risk from coastal erosion, as well as 1,600 kilometers of major roads, 650 kilometers of railway line, 92 railway stations, and 55 historic landfill sites. The report noted that the government's priority of reaching housing targets and economic goals was in direct conflict with sea level rise planning. It also mentioned that few people had any insurance to cope with losses, as in most of Europe.
So what's the outcome then? Do the Brits take action? And I know there's a little section on malaria, which seems a surprise. Tell us more about what's going to happen. What might happen?
The curveball I threw into this chapter was that there is already a mosquito from Asia that has made it to Italy that is bringing malaria. And malaria used to be actually quite common in the Thames estuary back in Dickensian times. But as the waters warm and rise, you can imagine there will be these more sort of swampy estuary areas. This is a distinct possibility that the mosquito makes its way north. So, of course, none of the northern countries are prepared for malaria. But in addition to that, the story continues to say that a young activist who I have met, who's only about 8 years old now, but that he goes on because of this malaria outbreak in his home county, that he is spurred to political action and becomes a member of parliament. So the interesting thing is that his mother has already gotten into politics as a result of the Extinction Rebellion activities in the UK, which people may be familiar with, very loud and colorful protests against government inaction. And she ran for her county council office for the Green Party. She didn't quite win, but she beat the Labour Party in the election. And I just really wanted to focus on young people and activism and people getting involved in this chapter as a way to pressure and eventually change government inaction.
And Leo becomes leader of the Green Party and becomes prime minister. Right?
So that's right.
And fixes everything?
No pressure, Leo.
Really? Well, those are fascinating looks at three different areas, Cook Islands, the North Atlantic, and the Thames Estuary, to give listeners a sense of the scope of the book.
The chapters conclude with key terms that we need to understand in order to change this devastation of our world. For example, resources, migrants, economy, evolution. As you've been saying over and over, all of it is really complex. There's an especially important term is transilience. What is transilience, and what does it suggest in terms of the human response to a changing world? I've heard resilience. Can you describe how transilience is different?
Yes, I'd be happy to. People talk a lot about climate resilience, and it means a lot of different things to different people. For some policymakers, it means let's build a seawall right here and protect this city. But that, to me, is not true resilience. Resilience is about bouncing back, and it's about sort of protecting what's there. The idea of transilience is actually a word I bumped up against in a dictionary one day, and it's a word from geology that describes the place in a, if you look at layers of rock, Mm-hmm. And there's a big sudden linear, like a jump between one kind and another kind, you know, that's very clearly demarcated in the land. That is transilience. Transilience is jumping ahead. So the silience part is either jumping back or jumping forward. And my thinking with this word, because we're looking really for transformative adaptation right now. We need to really take big jumps rather than, you know, small accommodations or changes. And so the idea of transilience is let's jump. Let's jump forward together. And this can happen in a lot of different ways. To me, it's like if we took all the money that we're subsidizing fossil fuel companies with right now, and we took all that money and we put it into, you know, green infrastructure or regenerative farming practices, you know, that would be a transilient move. It would be doing not less bad. It would be doing, you know, taking the money from the bad into the good zone, and that actually gives me a lot of hope, because I think, you know, it looks like there isn't enough room to fix this problem, but there can be, right? There can be if we make transformative leaps forward. And it's change is not linear either in the bad direction of, you know, the climate crisis, but it can also be nonlinear in the good direction. And it's really up to us as citizens and workers and individuals in our own lives to move away from the incremental change toward the really dramatic and transformative change.
So are we up to it? Are humans up to the task? Because we still are seeing resistance to the notion of climate change, not so much as it used to be. And there are people now who are starting to take it seriously, but it has to be taken very seriously by a lot more people. What is your level of optimism about people's ability to be transilient?
Yes, it is interesting. It feels overwhelming sometimes. It definitely feels like we're in a race to get this right in time, and it can, you know, it can be stressful and even depressing sometimes. But I think I'm an inveterate optimist. I believe in people. I think that part of what was great in this book is just learning how many people are working their hearts off to make this change happen. And a lot has changed even in the past 4 years since I began researching the book, in terms of awareness and even, you know, in terms of political leadership. But this change might not come from above. This is going to have to be a grassroots, all hands on deck, people powered change. And it, you know, it's like people say, "Is it going to be too little, too late?" Well, there's really no such thing, because we're all just going to keep moving forward, right? Like there's only just the future,
right?
And we're moving into it, and we can do it well, or we can do it badly. And if we do it well, that will bring, you know, yields of benefit to our children and our grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I would say morally imperative and absolutely critical that we do that. But we will bumble along a bit, and I hope that if everybody can take their biggest, boldest, bravest action, whatever your sphere of influence is, work within it, and, you know, figure out what you're good at and go do that thing for the benefit of the planet.
And so each individual needs to find that and do that.
I would say so. I mean, you know, I got the opportunity to write a book, so that, you know, that was sort of my next step. I don't know what comes after this, but it's, you know, I really am impressed with how many people are taking, you know, changing career paths, taking the bull by the horns, starting podcasts, doing all sorts of innovative things to write new stories. And that really does is what it comes down to, writing new stories and being the characters in this new story, not waiting for somebody else to do it.
You've worked with kids and adults in Half Moon Bay and beyond. I'd like to know a little bit about your work in Half Moon Bay. I have family who lives there.
Lovely.
And you're currently working with thought leaders and activists around the world to help communities create regenerative cultural systems. Can you tell us about how you're putting your ideas in your book into action?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the personal level. So, you know, just in our own lives over the past number of years, so, you know, we added solar to the house and we bought a couple of secondhand electric cars. You know, it feels good to unplug from a lot of the fossil fuels. It's hard, you know, because we can't, it's apparently impossible to live without plastic anymore.
It seems impossible. Like it, doesn't it? Yeah. Wow.
It's awful. So, you know, we all live a little bit in a land of compromise, but we're, you know, we're doing our best on our personal choices. And then, yeah, working in the community, you know, I'm leading a group of, it's called an art, well, There's a group called the Global Regeneration Collab. It's an online network, and there are a number of online networks of people who are professionals in the field or just active amateurs, interested people who are getting together to talk and collaborate. So I'm leading a weekly group there to look at how do we begin to build this new narrative of what are we working toward, right? It's easy to say what we don't want. It's a little bit harder to envision what is the thing that we're aiming for. What do we want? What do we need? And so that's my primary activity at the moment.
Nice.
Taking a little bit of a breather in the aftermath of the book. But really just trying to have community conversations and think about, help people to think in a systems thinking kind of way, that we are, you know, one species among many. And we need to, like as I said in the beginning of the show, like reintegrate ourselves into a natural system, into the world, so that we don't feel separate from, above, different than nature. But if we realize that we are nature, that everything we're doing to ourselves, you know, that to me is the next big story to tell, is how do we build an understanding, a cultural understanding, a belief system that really understands the human's place, humanity's place within the natural system. Mm-hmm.
We will look up the Global Regenerative Collab, take a look at it for ourselves. We'll also put a link up on our website, along with information about you and your book. We're about out of time. Our guest has been Christina Conklin. She's author and creator of some unique illustrations for the Atlas of Disappearing Places. It's published by New Press. We highly recommend it. It's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you, Christina, for being with us on Ecotopia.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. And remind you, if you would like to have our review copy of the Atlas of Disappearing Places, drop us a line at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com and let us know how to get it to you. We'll take a break now and listen to Bobby Tryon's North State, Give and Take.
North State Give and Take is made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling Cotton Party at 893-4923. And by the printed image providing screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. The printed image open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., and by appointment. More information at 530-898-9525. Welcome to North State Give and Take. I'm Bobby Tryon, and I interview nonprofits and people doing worthwhile things here in the North State. Today, I'm going to interview Pam Leary, and this is the second time that I've interviewed her, but what she does is very interesting, and she is with the Butte County Local Foods Network, right?
Yes.
And just to get that website, let's just put it in here to start.